They swept through the buildings, dormitories, a mess hall, offices, stores. Two generators purring in a shack constructed from concrete blocks and corrugated iron, an assay lab and a small clinic. A cold store with three bodies wrapped in black plastic sheeting. One had been badly mangled in some accident. The other two looked like suicides, a ligature of electrical cable around the neck, slashed wrists. Five more dead men were sprawled behind one of the dormitory huts, hands bound, chests torn by what appeared to be gunshot wounds, bullet holes in the hut's plank wall. Another body sprawled at the foot of the radio mast. His neck was broken, and Katya suggested that he had fallen while climbing.
"Climbing to escape from monsters like your patient on the crane," Captain Chernov said. "Or perhaps trying to escape from Americans who shot his friends. Perhaps they all went stir crazy in this damn fog," the chief petty officer said. "There was a quarrel. It got out of hand. Something drove them mad, perhaps," Captain Chernov said thoughtfully.
The prefab buildings were empty, although there were signs that people had left with some haste. Plates of food rotting on tables in the mess, papers scattered on the floor of the office, a record rotating on a gramophone in one of the dormitory huts, making an eerie, scratching click until Captain Chernov lifted the needle. The gun locker was open and empty, but apart from the five men who had been lined up and shot, there was no sign of any struggle. No blood spray, no bullet holes anywhere else, and no sign of the 16 men still unaccounted for.
"They ran off, or they were taken prisoner," Captain Chernov said. "If they ran off, we will find them. If they were taken prisoner, we will find the Americans who did it."
"With respect, I don't think this was anything to do with Americans," Katya said.
"The so-called libertarians took hostages for ransom when they attacked our trawlers and merchant ships," Captain Chernov said, "and executed them when no ransom was paid. What happened here, perhaps, was caused by some kind of psychological war weapon, a gas, a volatile drug. After the men were driven mad by it, the Americans walked in, shot the few still able to resist, and took the rest prisoner. I see you do not like this story, Doctor. Well, if you have a better idea about what happened here, I should like to hear it."
"I don't have enough evidence to form a hypothesis," Katya said, and realized that it sounded stiff and priggish and defensive. The captain smiled. He was having fun with her.
"You hope to find monsters. You hope for fame. Very well. Let's go look for them."
Katya trailed after the party of seamen as Captain Chernov and the chief petty officer led them along the quayside, past pyramidal heaps of ore, past a row of articulated dump trucks, powerful machines with six-wheel drive and rugged tires as tall as a person. They moved slowly and cautiously through the fog, checking under the trucks, checking shipping containers and stacks of empty crates. Arkady Serentsev hung back with Katya, asking her if she really thought monsters had attacked the station, if they were right now feeding on men they had killed.
"That's what the captain thinks, I think," Katya said.
"Do you think he is wrong about something driving the men crazy?"
"If I had to guess, I'd say it was something to do with the isolation," Katya said. "That and the fog."
"But not, you think, Americans,"
Arkady Serentsev said. He had a nice smile and a cool attitude, had knotted a red handkerchief at the throat of his tonyashka shirt. He plucked a pack of cigarettes from the pocket of his jacket and offered it to Katya. When she refused with a shake of her head, he put the pack to his lips, plucked out a cigarette, and lit it with a heavy petrol lighter fashioned from a 50-cal cartridge case.
"If I didn't know better, I'd think that your captain was looking for an excuse to take on the American research ship," she said.
"The captain's father was one of the pioneer settlers," Arkady said. "We all resent the capitalists with their nuclear rockets and supercomputers and frontier mentality, but the pioneer families especially resent them. As far as the captain is concerned, their offer of help is a personal insult."
Katya had once sort of dated a Navy diver who one drunken night had told her how a friend of his had come to the surface too quickly because his dive computer had malfunctioned. He had been stricken with the bends, screaming with the pain of nitrogen bubbles in his joints, fed vodka by his mates because they had no way of treating him. Their patrol boat had been making a hopeless dash to the nearest port when an American frigate, which had intercepted its call for help, had caught up with it and had taken off the stricken man and treated him in its decompression chamber. Katya's boyfriend had tried to make it into a joke, saying that his friend had not only beaten the bends, but had discovered a tremendous hangover cure into the bargain. But it was the usual sad story of crazy Russian machismo combined with a massive inferiority complex. She said to Arkady, "I know your captain took things very personally in the war against the libertarians. He disobeyed orders when he staged that raid, yes, but he captured an important warlord and his entourage, and also rescued more than 20 hostages." She had to smile at Arkady's sudden passion. "You think he's a hero?" "One time, 2 years ago, we had the job of visiting a small island close to the South Pole," Arkady said. "Very remote, very desolate. No one lives there, but it is important we have a claim on it. A previous expedition set up a beacon and also landed goats there. The idea was that they would breed and provide a source of fresh meat to any ships that passed by. We were tasked to clean the beacon's solar panels and replace its storage battery, and also to find out how the goats were doing." "I can imagine what Captain Chernov thought about that. He believed that he was keeping the borders of the People's Republic safe," Arkady said. "That is what he told us, at any rate. Well, a small party of us land. We cannot find any trace of the goats. Not so much as a bone. There are pancake crabs everywhere, though. So we think the goats died and the crabs ate them. The island is a volcanic cone, extinct. Black rocks, tangles of thorny bushes, and everywhere, pancake crabs. Watching us from under stones, creeping close to us whenever we stop as we climb to where the beacon was placed. All the way around the top of the island's cone, there is a thick belt of feather palms, smaller than the ones on the big island, but still much taller than anything else growing there. And there are pancake crabs in the palms. As we make our way through them, the crabs drop on us. They stick to our skin with those suckers they have. We have to prise them off. It is disgusting, but we do not think it dangerous. At the top, there is a caldera, a deep funnel with a lake at the bottom. We find the beacon and do our work. We rest up, and a couple of idiots roll a boulder over the edge. It drops into the lake far below and makes a big splash. And after the ripples die away, there is another splash. More ripples. As if something had woken down there." "You found a monster?" "We did not see anything, just the splash and the ripples. And we did not have any way of climbing down, so we start back down, and the wind changes direction, and it begins to rain. And then two of us become sick. An allergic reaction to the pancake crabs, we find out later. It rains harder, rain blowing sideways on the wind, and when we get to the inlet where we left the boat, we find big waves rolling in, and the boat has floated off, is riding on the waves at the mouth of the inlet. Captain Chernov strips off and swims out to the boat, but he can't bring it near the rocks where the rest of us are waiting because the waves are too fierce. And by now the two sick men are very sick indeed, and they can't swim out. So he motors off to the Ekranoplan and comes back with a rocket line, shoots it from boat to shore, and uses it to swing the sick men above the waves to the boat, and everyone is saved." "What about the monster?" "We didn't go back to look. But while we wait to be rescued, we have some bad thoughts about it. Imagine it creeping up the cliffs inside the caldera, creeping toward where we are sheltering. But the point is, whatever they say about the captain, he is not a monster. He did the right thing in the war, and the brass punished him because he made them look bad. Listen to that.
It isn't dogs, is it? It is in no way any kind of dog.
It doesn't sound like pigs either, Katya said.
The monotonous barking was loud and close now, coming from somewhere beyond a low rise crowned with a clump of bottle brush trees. Katya and Arkady watched as Captain Chernov and three seamen made a forking run, passing left and right around the trees, disappearing into streaming whiteness. 2 minutes passed. Three. No shots. No shouts. Katya's heart beat high as she strained to see into the fog. She badly wanted to know what was making that noise, but her hindbrain was telling her to run far and run fast. Arkady lit another cigarette, and Katya pretended that she didn't see the flame of his lighter trembling when he applied it. The barking continued without pause. Eventually, one of the seamen appeared on top of the ridge, a shadowy figure in the haze, scissoring his arms over his head to indicate the all-clear. There was a vegetable garden on the other side of the ridge, neat rows of potatoes and cabbage, enclosed by a double fence of wire mesh to keep out pancake crabs, green leaves vivid and alien against the purples of the belt of native scrub beyond. And there was a paddock of bare earth inside a fence of wooden stakes and wire where two pigs lay in a muddy wallow, flanks heaving as they hacked and barked. Each time they coughed, bloody froth burst from their muzzles. The bodies of three other pigs lay swollen and rotting nearby, avid crowds of pancake crabs jostling and burrowing into them. Katya caught a strong whiff of ripe decay as she leaned against the fence. It seemed to tint the fog with the monochrome hue of grief.
"Here are your monsters, Doctor," Captain Chernov told her. "Would you care to examine them?"
The chief petty officer wanted to put the pigs out of their misery. Katya said that they should try to find out what had infected them first, and was surprised when Captain Chernov agreed.
"This sickness could be a reaction to a nerve agent," he said.
"Or something they caught from the local biota," Katya said.
"Native diseases do not infect people," Captain Chernov said, "or pigs."
"It hasn't happened yet," Katya said. "But life on Earth and Venus shares the same genetic code and presumably the same common ancestor. As far as Venusian viruses and bacteria are concerned, people and pigs are no more than new sets of mucous membranes to be penetrated, new masses of cytoplasm to be exploited and subverted."
"First you hope to find monsters," Captain Chernov said. "Now you hope to find the Venusian flu. Your expectations are dwindling, Doctor. If you want to make yourself useful, help Mr. Sarantsev search the offices for diaries, logs, any records that might reveal what happened. Meanwhile, I must look for the missing miners, although I am pretty sure I will not find them."
"Because the Americans took them?"
"I'm sure that, like all scientists, you believe in logic. And logic tells us that if they are not here, they must be somewhere else,"
Captain Chernov said, and told Arkady to make sure that Dr. Ignatova did not get into any trouble, and roared off with the rest of his men toward the open cast mine in two trucks. Katya found a log in the station's small clinic, found an entry 3 weeks old that noted two men displaying symptoms of a flu-like infection, high temperatures, involuntary movements of the arms and legs, night sweats, recovery within 24 hours. By then, more men had become infected. It had swiftly passed through the camp, and everyone appeared to have succumbed, including the station's chemist, who doubled as its medical officer. In the assay lab, Katya found a photograph showing him standing with his two teenage daughters in front of the first footstep monument on Big Island. A gangling, sandy-haired man with heavy-framed glasses and a high forehead. She had seen him before. He was one of the men who had been shot to death. His name was Georgi Zhonov. For a week after the last men came down with what he called 24-hour flu, he'd made only routine notes in his log. Then there was a terse entry about a suicide. A man had hanged himself. Another man walked in front of a truck. More entries, fist fights, a non-fatal stabbing, broken bones due to drunkenness. Two men disappeared one night, three the next. One was found clinging to the top of a tall tree and brought down. The next day, he was found dead, his wrists slashed open. A man hanged himself, four others disappeared. The last note in Georgi Zhionov's neat, slanting script read, "I suffer from the most vivid and peculiar dreams." Katya found the forms certifying the deaths of the suicides with notes on blood work. Georgi Zhionov had run samples through his gas spectrometer, looking for heavy metals and toxins, finding only trace levels of tin and titanium, well within expected limits. He had also examined the blood of two pigs. Katya felt a chill at the base of her spine. The men had become ill. The pigs had become ill. Georgi Zhionov had been trying to find a link, and because he was a metallurgist, he had used the tools of his trade. There was a geological map on one wall of his little lab. Katya studied it carefully. The broad curve of the shoreline, with sandbars running parallel to it, a black rectangle marking the site of the station, a series of steeply contoured ridges rising behind, with red stipplings indicating known deposits of ore. The site of the open-cast mine was marked on the first ridge by a cross-hatched rectangle. She ran her finger along the top of the ridge, noting the high spots. Arkady Srensev, searching the disordered office of the mining station's commandant, had made his own discovery. "Fish," he told Katya. "Fish? A lot of fish." Arkady waggled a video disc. "Luckily for us, the commandant liked to make home movies." It was short, choppily edited, panning shots across windrows of black fish on a sandbar that faded into fog, black fish rising and falling on shallow waves, a zoom shot closing on fish shimmying and leaping out of the water, landing on fish already dead or dying, skinny, armor-plated fish with pale gill ruffs and bulbous eyes, a close-up that included the cameraman's boots, showing several fish writhing in circles, snapping at their own tails. Men scooping fish into buckets, tipping the buckets into oil drums in the well of a skiff. Men shoveling fish into the water. Men throwing fish at each other. A small bulldozer rolling back and forth in the fog, turning up combers of sand and fish and pushing them into the water. Waves rolling in, black with blood, agitated by the splashing of scavengers come to feed. Katya insisted on replaying the scenes of the men at work. 10 men, 20, 25, and the cameraman, the commandant, made 26. Everyone in the mining station had joined in the macabre beach party, and none of them had worn protective clothing. Most were dressed in bathing trunks and flip-flops. Several were buck naked.
"When was this?" she said.
4 weeks ago," Arkady said.
"And a week later, the men started to become sick," she said, and gave a quick account of Georgi Zhornov's notes. The suicides, the disappearances, the cryptic note about dreams. Arkady showed her the commandant's diary, notes on patrols sent to search the forest behind the station, of sightings of men or man-shaped animals, of strange noises. Toward the end, the commandant's handwriting degenerated to a jagged scrawl. The last entry consisted of a few indecipherable words and drawings of skulls, fanged devil faces, daggers dripping blood.
"So you think it was the fish?" Arkady said. "The fish infected them, or they ate the fish and it made them sick, sick in the body and in the head."
"It may be slightly more complicated than that," Katya said. "I think they fed the pigs with some of the fish. I need to examine them."
She found boxes of vinyl gloves in the little lab and face masks she soaked in bleach. It wasn't much protection, but it was the best she could manage. She didn't want to get close to the pigs, not without wearing a full contamination suit, so she and Arkady rigged a sampler from a scaffold pole and a cup taped to the end, and, after some maneuvering, managed to collect a draft of froth from one of them. She treated it like plutonium, carefully tipping it into a plastic bottle and double-bagging the bottle. She had noticed no less than 6 microscopes stacked in unopened boxes in the lab. No doubt the result of the same kind of supply error in central stores that had packed the Ekranoplan stores with tins of no other kind of soup but pumpkin. She set one up on the knife-scarred butcher's table in the kitchen of the mess, then used a rolling pin to knock out a window. 6 microscopes, she told Arkady, but not 1 microscope slide. She plucked a small splinter of window glass, put on a fresh set of vinyl gloves, adjusted her mask, smeared a drop of pig sputum on the splinter, and set it on the platform of the microscope, and bent over it, and adjusted the focus knob until the smear swam into focus. Nothing. She swept the platform on which the splinter was clamped back and forth, fingertips sweating on the vernier knobs, on the fine focus knob, feeling a touch of the funk she remembered from undergraduate practical classes when she'd failed to see the thing she was meant to see. What do you see? Arkady said. Nothing. But it doesn't mean anything. She had explained her idea on the way to sample the stricken pig sputum, explained that Georgi Zhonov had been on the right track, but he had been looking in the wrong place. On Earth, she told Arkady, there were diseases passed from animals to humans, zoonoses. It was possible that the brain-burning flu was one such. The miners had fed their pigs with raw fish, all that free protein willingly throwing itself ashore. And an infection carried by the fish had flourished in the animals. They had become reaction vessels growing ill, coughing up infected sputum. Perhaps the man who fed the pigs had become ill first, then had infected everyone else. Or perhaps the men had become infected after eating undercooked pork. Katya had been hoping that it was some kind of parasite, something she could see under the microscope, worms, fungal cells, spores, cysts. Something you could show the captain, Arkady said. He was a quick study. It could be a bacterium, Katya said, or a virus. Viruses are generally not much bigger than the wavelength of visible light, so hard to see with a conventional microscope like this. I'll find out exactly what it is when I get the samples to a fully equipped lab, but it has to be something native, something that affects the behavior of its host. It made the fish beach themselves. It made the miners hallucinate, made them believe they were being attacked, made some of them kill themselves, made some of them kill their friends. I think the rest ran off into the countryside. But you can't prove it. Not here, not yet. Unless Captain Chernov has found the missing men. He hadn't. His search party had scoured the strip mine from one end to the other and returned to the station with 2 bodies they had found at the base of a vertical rock face. But there was no sign of the rest, 6 by Katya's count. Captain Chernov was convinced that they had been captured or killed by raiders, but listened to Katya's pressie of Georgi Zhonov's notes and watched the video. At the end, he said, "The pigs became sick. The men became sick. And you want to link them with this. What did you call it?"
"A zoonosis," Katya said.
"But you have no proof."
"There is the timing. The men started to become sick a week after the fish washed up. If they fed some of the fish to the pigs, it's long enough for an infection to develop."
"The man on the crane, was he coughing?"
"No, he was crazy. And the dead men we found, they died from their own hand or from bullets, not some parasite." "Men and pigs are similar but not identical. The pigs might have caught some illness. Maybe from the fish, why not? But what happened to the men is different. It is clear that their minds were affected. On Earth, there are many examples of parasites that alter the behavior of their hosts," Katya said. "We are not on Earth," Captain Chernov said. "And this is nothing to do with parasites. The men were driven mad, that is clear. But by what? I think it could very well be the result of the testing of some kind of psychological war weapon. A poison gas, perhaps. A gas that does not kill, but alters the mind. The Americans deployed it here in this remote place, observed the results, then captured the survivors.
And now they return pretending to help, but really wanting to capture us in case we have discovered the evidence of what they did. And your talk of disease could help them, Doctor. Have you thought of that? Suppose the Americans claim that this was due to a native disease that infects people. Suppose they present false evidence to back up their story. We would have to quarantine this station and perhaps evacuate the others. Leave the coast open for the Americans to claim. Well, we will not run. We will defend this place. We will engage the enemy. We will uncover the truth about the atrocity they committed here. Do that for me, Doctor. Find the truth, not fairy tales.
He would not look at the map, would not listen to Katya's idea about where the last of the miners could be hiding. He had worked up a story that satisfied his prejudices, and he was not going to change his mind. The enemy had done this. They were returning to the scene of the crime. They must be punished. The chief petty officer and two seamen were left to guard the station. Everyone else went back to the Akranoplan. Katya wasn't confined to her cabin, but the hatches to the observation deck and the wings were locked down, and Captain Chernov made it clear that the bridges were off limits. She spent a little time writing up a report, trying to keep it as dispassionate as possible. She wasn't sure if anyone would read it, but she had to put down the facts and her own conclusions. Overhead, something rumbled and whined. She wondered if it was something to do with the missile launch tubes mounted on the top of the Akranoplan. When she was finished, she couldn't stay in her cabin. The Akranoplan was full of restless activity. Men clattering up and down ladders, along companionways, loud voices, a general excitement. Three seamen cleaning carbines in the mess hall ignored Katya as she pottered in the gallery, ignored her when she left carrying two mugs of tea. She found Arkady Sarantsev in the fire control bay, handed him one of the mugs. He told her that Captain Chernov had reported to Central Command in Kosmograd, and they had taken him seriously. A 300-kilometer exclusion zone had been declared along the coast, and all American and British vessels had been ordered to leave it. The Americans had lodged a formal protest and were sending two frigates to back up their research vessel, which had turned around 50 kilometers from shore and was heading away. Arkady brought up the missile guidance system's radar on the big central screen, the long line of the coast, the hard green dot of the research vessel with a little block of white figures beside it. "We are waiting for clearance to engage," he said. Katya felt a fluttering agitation in her blood. "To fire missiles at it?" Arkady sipped from his mug of tea. "To head out and capture it. The captain believes that it carries evidence of a Psy War attack on the station, and Central Command is discussing that idea. He'll attack anyway, won't he? Like he did before, except this time he could start a war. He will do the right thing. You know there was no American plot. You know that the miners became infected with something that drove them crazy. You know the survivors are hiding, like the poor man up in the crane." Arkady studied her for a moment with a look of regret. "We are friends, you and I. But I am also an officer of the Navy of the People's Republic, and I serve under the man who saved my life," he said and pulled aside the collar of his striped Tonyashka shirt to show a white weal on his shoulder. "I was one of those who had an allergic reaction to pancake crab spit on that island." "So you won't help me," Katya said. "I advise you to let us do our work." "That's what I thought," Katya said. "But I had to ask because I'm not sure if I can do this alone." Arkady's eyes widened and he dropped his mug of tea and raised his hand. Too late. Katya whacked him on the side of his head with the socks stuffed with dried beans, whacked him again, and his eyes rolled back and he slid out of his chair and fell to the floor. She ransacked his pockets and found a set of keys, then laid him on his side in the recovery position and headed toward the nearest hatch. No one saw her drop from one of the wings into the cool water, a drop higher than she'd expected, plunging her a good meter below the surface. And although her entire skin tingled with anticipation as she swam to shore, no one raised the alarm or shot at her. She was a strong swimmer. She had met the Navy diver when he had noticed her in the pool of the spa in the Druzhba Sanatorium, high in the mountains of Big Island. Wearing only her underwear, she crested confidently through the cool, calm water, her clothes and shoes in a bag belted to her waist. The fog's vaporous ceiling hung about a meter over the surface. Fog drew a veil all around her. It was as if she were swimming in a private bubble. As she neared the quay, she heard the barking of the pigs, and with a pang of regret, wished that she had asked Arkady to shoot them after she had taken her sample. But he would have probably refused because Captain Chernov wanted to keep them alive to prove his ridiculous theory. She hoped Arkady wouldn't get into trouble because she had stolen his keys. She hoped he would understand why she'd done it. She hoped he would forgive her. No one challenged her when she climbed onto the quay. She ran past the heap of ore to the parked trucks and paused, breathing hard, listening. Nothing but the labored bark of the poor pigs. No shouts or sirens, no warning shots. She squeezed water from her hair and knotted it in a loose ponytail, pulled on her shirt and cargo pants and shoes, and climbed into the cab of the truck at the far end of the row. She'd driven heavy vehicles like it when, in the long vacation at the end of her first university year, she'd worked at the construction site for the sports center her mother had designed. Power steering, synchromesh gears, no problem. No one challenged her when she pressed the start button and the big engine coughed into life, but as she drove off, she saw in the side mirrors a man chasing after her, waving frantically as he fell behind and vanished into the fog. The truck rode easily and smoothly up a winding, graded road. Perched in the high, roomy cab, cool air blasting out of the air conditioning, her clothes drying stiffly, Katya drove as fast as she dared in the fog, navigating by the GPS map in the dashboard screen and red lights set on posts at 20-meter intervals on either side of the road. A never-ending chain of stars appearing out of the fog, drifting past, vanishing. She imagined men running for the trucks, speeding after her. Nothing showed in the side mirrors, but visibility was down to less than 20 meters. She wouldn't know she was being chased until they were right on the tail of the truck's hopper. The road grew steeper. She shifted down again, and at last it topped out. Trying to match the GPS map with reality, she drove past a pair of bulldozers, some kind of mobile conveyor belt, and a string of prefab huts before a terraced cliff horizontally striped with dark ore deposits loomed out of the fog. She turned right, driving across packed dirt, skirting around a spoil heap that rose into streaming whiteness, past the tower and hoppers of a screening plant. Then a faint red light appeared to her left, and she turned toward it, realizing with tremendous relief that she had found the road that led to the top of the ridge. It switched back up steep, wooded slopes. Trees grew on either side, stabbing up into the fog. Some were a little like conifers or a child's drawing of conifers, stiff radial branches strung with puffballs of fine needles that condensed water droplets from the fog. Others were hung with what looked like tattered sails or bunches of ragged, velvety straps that sparkled with condensation in the truck's headlights. Puffballs and straps and sails were tinted deep purple. Venusian plants used a pigment similar to rhodopsin to capture light for photosynthesis. Fat cushions of black moss saddled between the trees. Everything was dripping wet. A shape loomed out of the fog, a yellow, articulated dump truck exactly like the one she was driving, tipped nose down in the deep ditch at the side of the road. She slowed as she went past, craning to look inside the truck's cab, seeing that it was empty and feeling a measure of relief, feeling that she was on the right track. The oppressive shroud of the fog began to lift and break up into streamers caught amongst branches and sails, and she drove on in pewter light, trees thinning to scattered clumps with rough scrub between. The road turned and gave out abruptly, and a truck was slewed at its end. The men had come here, all right, trying to escape the monsters in their heads by driving out of the fog to the place they came to play and relax. Katya drove past the truck, drove across a rough meadow, past a barbecue pit and picnic tables, jolting on up a steepening slope until even in its lowest gear the truck could climb no farther. She switched off the motor and swung out of the cab, looked back at the way she had come, a pure white sea stretched toward the horizon, seamlessly melding with the ivory dome of the planet's permanent cloud cover. The sun was a bright smear low in the east. In less than 20 days, it would set at this latitude, and the long night, 117 days long, would begin. 40 kilometers above, a lightning storm flashed and flickered under the cloud roof. She heard the distant, dull percussion of thunder, saw thin, shadowy twists of falling rain that would evaporate before they hit the ground. There was still no sign of pursuit, but she did not doubt that she was being followed and began to climb toward the top of the ridge. Steep, stony slopes sparsely stubbled with purple vegetation, squat vases, skull-sized puffballs, clumps of stiff, thorny whips or tall plumes. The air was very still, weighted with sultry heat. Long shadows tangled everywhere. She was sweating hard, out of breath, her pulse hammering in her ears, when at last she reached the top of the ridge and saw the crests of further ridges rising above the fog. Parallel rakes stretching toward the distant prospect of a stark mountain range, the beginning of the desert interior. Ahead of her, the broad ridge ran out toward a high prow crowned with a copse of trees. A horn blared far below. She felt a spike of alarm, saw a yellow dump truck draw up beside hers, saw three men spill from it. As she jogged toward the copse of trees, a speck materialized in the distance, scooting above the shadow it cast on the restless sea of fog, cutting through wisps of drifting vapor, rising as it tracked toward her. It was one of the Ekranoplan's drones, a chunky quadricopter like a garbage can lid pierced by a cross, with a caged rotor at the end of each bar of the cross. Its cluster of cameras glinted as it buzzed past her and turned and came back, flying low and fast, a homicidal frisbee aimed at her head. She dropped flat, felt the backwash of the drone's fans blow over her, pushed to her feet as the quadricopter curved around and shot toward her again, and ran toward a clump of thorns at the edge of a steep drop. She broke off one of the dead canes in the core of the clump and swung it at the drone, and the machine veered sideways and made a wide turn and came back toward her, moving in cautious, erratic spurts, halting a few meters away. There was a metallic clatter, and a voice said, "Stay where you are, Doctor. Wait for my men." "Is that you, Captain? If you care to follow me, I'll lead you to the missing miners."
"You disobeyed a direct order, Doctor. But if you come back now, I'll overlook your transgression."
"They climbed up here looking for a place where they'd be safe," Katya said, and pointed toward the trees.
The quadricopter drone tilted and shot forward, and she jumped over the edge and plowed down the steep slope in a cloud of dust and small stones, fetching up breathless and bleeding in a clump of stiff purple plumes. She had lost the thorn cane. The drone was falling toward her, and she snapped off a plume and thrust it like a spear into one of the machine's fans. There was a grinding noise, and a stinging blizzard of shards and splinters sprayed around her, and the drone spun past, canted at a steep angle. It tried to turn back toward Katya, and the mismatched thrust of its fans spun it in a death spiral, and it struck a shelf of rock and clattered away down the slope, bouncing and shedding parts. The three men climbing toward her paused as the wreckage of the drone spun past, then started to climb again. It took all of Katya's strength to scramble back up the slope. She paused at the top, her pulse drumming in her skull, and blotted sweat and blood from her eyes. Flying splinters had badly cut her face. The men were much closer now. The chief petty officer shouted something to her, and she turned and limped along the crest of the ridge, hot pain knifing in one ankle. Hot air clamped around her like a fever sheet. The world contracted to the patch of stony dirt directly in front of her feet. She scrambled up a steep gully, mostly on all fours, only realized that she reached the top when the shadows of the trees fell across her. They were rooted amongst black boulders, upright trunks soaring skyward, stiff horizontal branches clad in bunches of purple needles. A man lay on his back on a dry litter of fallen needles, eyes shrunken in their sockets, cracked lips flecked with froth. Katya thought he was dead, but then he turned his head toward her and started to tremble and whimper. Both his legs were broken. She could see bone sticking out of the shin of his torn trousers. A rifle lay some way off. She supposed that he'd dropped it when he'd fallen. She knelt beside him and took one of his hands and asked him where his friends were. His eyes rolled back. She thought he had fainted. Then she understood and looked up, and saw small shadows high up in the jutting branches, half hidden by puffball clusters of needles, atavistic apes clinging to the safety of their perches. Katya held on to the man's hand as the chief petty officer and two seamen stepped toward her.
"I don't know why he didn't have you killed," her mother said.
"Chernov didn't have a plan," Katya said. "He had a fixation, a belief that everything that he saw was the result of some fiendish American plot. He was trying to stop me, yes, but he was also trying to rescue me from what he believed to be my own foolishness. When his men saw that I had found the miners, that was the end of it.
I suppose we should for once be grateful for the rigid code of honor men value so highly."
Arkady called him a hero, and he acted like one.
"And now you are the hero, my daughter who saved the world from war.
From a stupid skirmish created by that rigid code of honor. And I was wrong about too many things to qualify as any kind of hero. I was wrong about what infected the miners to begin with."
They were talking over lunch. Katya and the crew of the Akranoplan had just been released from quarantine, and her mother had whisked her away from the scrum of reporters and onlookers and a crew from the state TV news to the calm of the luncheon room of the Engineers' Union, with its views across the simmering basin of Kosmograd and the blue curve of Crater Bay. The other diners were openly staring at them, and not for once because they were the only two women in the room. Katya wore the shirt and cargo pants in which she'd been released. Her mother wore a severely cut white suit that emphasized her slim figure and her trademark red-framed glasses.
"You weren't wrong, dear," she said. "The men had been infected by something that drove them mad. But it wasn't a bug or a parasite, and it didn't have anything to do with the pigs. And we have only circumstantial evidence that it had anything to do with the fish."
It had taken several weeks of tests in the Naval Hospital to determine that the miners had been infected by a kind of prion, an infectious agent that closely resembled a misfolded version of a protein found in neurons in the amygdala, the small subcortical structure in the brain that regulated both fear and pleasure responses. The prion catalyzed the misfolding of those proteins, creating an imbalance of neurotransmitters and triggering an exaggerated version of the fight-or-flight reaction and release of massive amounts of adrenaline and other hormones. The psychotic breaks and hallucinations suffered by the miners had been attempts to rationalize uncontrollable emotional thunderstorms. Katya wanted very much to prove that the prion had been present in the blood of the fish which had beached themselves. As for the pigs, they had been infected by a parasitic threadworm, but it had only affected their respiratory systems and did not seem to be transmissible to humans. She had been right in thinking that the miner's madness was due to an infection, but had gotten every detail wrong because she had based her ideas on terrestrial examples. She had made the mistake of arguing from analogy, of trying to map stories from Earth on the actuality of Venus, and the fit had been imperfect.
"I saw two different things," she told her mother, "and tried to make them part of the same story. Captain Chernov was right about that, at least. He was wrong about everything else, and you are too hard on yourself," her mother said fondly. "I wonder where I got that from. Can the poor men you rescued be cured?" "They're under heavy sedation and undergoing cognitive therapy. They're no longer scared to death, but purging the prions from their brains won't be easy. It sounds as if you have found a new project."
"I'm wondering if it's a general problem," Katya said. "This particular prion caused a gross behavioral change, but there may be others that have more subtle effects.
We think that we are separate from the biosphere of Venus, yet it is clear that we are not. All of us, Russians, Americans, British, we have more in common with each other than with the people from our homelands. We came from Earth, but we are all Venusians now. Venus is in our blood and our minds. So you have a new research topic and a new way of getting into trouble, her mother said. What about this new man of yours?
We're taking it slowly. He forgave me, at least, for giving him a bad concussion and injuring his pride. Although Arkady had said, the first time they had met in quarantine, that if he had been piloting the drone, he would have had no problem returning the favor.
A man who puts love before pride, her mother said. Now there's a lovely example of a new way of thinking.
Matthew Hughes. Matthew Hughes was born in Liverpool, England, but spent most of his adult life in Canada. He's worked as a journalist, as a staff speechwriter for the Canadian Ministers of Justice and Environment, and as a freelance corporate and political speechwriter in British Columbia before settling down to write fiction full-time. Clearly strongly influenced by Jack Vance, as an author, Hughes has made his reputation detailing the adventures of rogues like Hengis Hapthorne, Guth Bandar, and Luff Imbri, who live in the era just before that of the Dying Earth, in a series of popular stories and novels that include Fool's Errant, Fool Me Twice, Black Brilliant, Magistrum, Hespira, The Spiral Labyrinth, Template, Quartet and Triptych, The Yellow Cabochon, The Other, and The Commons, with his stories being collected in The Gist Hunter and other stories. His most recent books are the novels in his urban fantasy Hell and Back trilogy, The Damned Busters and Costume Not Included, and Hell to Pay. He also writes crime fiction as Matt Hughes and media tie-in novels as Hugh Matthews. In the deliciously sly tale that follows, he takes us to Venus, the planet of love, to show us that while love might be an irresistible force, sometimes it's a good idea to give resisting it your very best shot.
Greaves and the Evening Star by Matthew Hughes. Read for you by Stephen Fry. I threw back the covers and sat up. Greaves, I said, I had the most bally awful dream. I am sorry to hear it, sir. He handed me the morning cup and saucer, and I took the sip without which the Gloucester day cannot begin. The ordinary day, that is, in the common run of things, not the kind of day that follows a night of revelry and riot at the Inertia Club, when one awakes with the sense that death is not only imminent, but cannot arrive soon enough. I dreamt that Baldy Spots Binkle had lured me onto Slithy Tove Whipley's homemade rocket ship, battened down the hatch, if batten's the word I want. It is, sir. Righto. And then we'd blasted off for Venus. Not the statue, mind, but the Evening Star itself, and that we'd slept like that Winkle chap for months on end before pitching up at Baldy's estate in the middle of the most dismal swamp imaginable. Greaves inclined his head in a manner I recognized as conveying sympathy. I ploughed on, the dream as real to me as the vital oolong of which I now took a second fortifying draught. It was a place steeped in gloom, where the sun never shows its face, all stagnant pools and sluggish streams, with only the occasional dab of what we might call solid earth. Oh, dear, sir. Ah, well, I said, motioning with my unencumbered hand to indicate that the unpleasant figments were fast dwindling in life's rear-view mirror. Draw the curtains, will you, Greaves, and admit the smiles of rosy-fingered... Sir, you must prepare yourself for a disagreeable prospect, he said. Rain? I hazarded a guess. stiff winds? Not the winds, he said, throwing aside the heavy cloths to reveal panes streaked with rivulets whose flows were perpetually interrupted by the impact of freshly arrived droplets the size of marbles. I rose from the bed and went to the window. It can justly be said that while Bartholomew Gloucester may occasionally be surprised, and now and then, when circumstances so conspire, even awestruck, it is rare that he is actually staggered. Yet I was staggered by the view from the window. The cup and saucer fell unnoticed from a nerveless hand, though not unnoticed by the ever-vigilant Greaves, who deftly caught them without the spilling of a drop. "I say, Greaves," I said. "I mean to say!" Though what I meant to say I did not know. It was scarcely a moment for the mot juste. "Indeed, sir." As far as the eye could stretch, whatever wasn't grey was green, and whatever wasn't green was grey. Even so, every green was well tinged by the grey, and all was being relentlessly battered from above by unending bucketloads of rain. "This," I declared, "will not do." Greaves agreed. "Most disturbing, sir." There sprang into my mind, like Athena springing from the brow of Zeus, only the other way round, a plan. First, a bath, then breakfast, then a brisk and businesslike dialogue with Baldy, leading to the earliest possible embarkation on Slithy's contraption, and so to home. I gathered myself and issued instructions. Greaves moved out of view, and an instant later I heard water running in the bathroom. "Right," I said, shedding the pyjamas like a snake with a pressing agenda, while figuratively girding myself for strife. "And off we go." "Baldy," I said, over the remains of a remarkably large kipper and an even larger than remarkable egg, "we must speak."
"Agreed, Barty," he said. "It's why I had Slithy bring you."
I should pause briefly to furnish a sketch of Archibald Spots Binkle, the better to focus the reader's inner eye on the proceedings. Imagine a fish in a fairy godmother tale, magically transformed into a man afflicted with horn-rimmed specs, except that the FG in question has skimped on the incantation, so that the transmogrification was only 9 parts out of 10. Bulbous eyes, protruding lips that are ever moist, glabrous skin with just a hint of scaliness. Now add a voice that sounds like the product of a child's first involuntary sawings at the violin, and you have Baldy taped and targeted. Thus it would come as no surprise to discover that the sole abiding passion of his existence has been a fascination with newts. This was the pallid apparition that blinked dully at me across the breakfast table as I unburdened myself of a few trenchant observations on the damage done to a lifelong friendship by a ruddy shanghaiing off to a sodden planet one wouldn't wish on one's direst foe. When in distress, it was Baldy's habit to draw his neck into his meagre shoulders to a depth greater than ought to have been anatomically possible. The effect was rather like that of a fish trying on an impression of a turtle. He performed this manoeuvre now, and I formed the view that once I ceased beleaguering him, he would advance a suitably penitent apology, allowing me to be magnanimous in victory, as befits my nature. I therefore softened my tone and relinquished the floor, although as we were sitting, I'm not sure exactly what I was relinquishing. But instead of tendering his regrets, my old chum thrust his narrow neck back out of concealment and said, "Oh, fie, Barty." "Fie," I said. "I am often taken aback when confronted by raw injustice."
"Yes, fie," he returned, "and double fie at that."
"Steady on, Baldy," I said. "Bear in mind that some fies, once launched, can never be recalled." He elevated his negligible chin.
"I don't care, Barty," he told me. "It's all meaningless, else."
"Else what?"
"What do you mean?" he said.
"What do you mean?" I said. The bulging eyes blinked several times.
"Stop repeating what I say," he snapped. "This is no time for childish games."
"Childish games?" I said. "Well, I must say, that's a bit over the top, coming from a fellow who would have a dashed hard time demonstrating that he's reached man's estate." His pale skin grew even paler, and flecks of spittle appeared on his lower lip. I experienced a sudden memory of the only time Baldy Spots Binkle, in our long-ago school days, had lost his rag while being bullied by Roderick Bass Huntingdon, a thug in an Eton collar, who reigned over the junior form in much the same way Tiglath Pileser, if that's the bloke I want, had lorded it over the 10 Lost Tribes. I remembered piercing shrieks and a flailing of stick-thin limbs like a stringed puppet whose master is overcome by a fit of apoplexy. All ending, of course, in tears, Bass Huntingdon's schoolyard sobriquet of Basher being well earned. But here, in Baldy's breakfast room, the anticipated frenzy did not occur. Instead, he burst into tears, then buried his snuffles in his cold, long-fingered hands. It was a good thing I had already breakfasted, since here was a sight to quell the appetite of a cyclops. "Steady on, Baldy," I said for the second time in mere moments, but my tone was now softer. Barty Gloucester might be able to summon the stern eye and the censorious word as warranted, but when an old pal breaks down and blubs across the breakfast table, the better angels sit up and seize the reins. Admittedly, I waffled a bit as to whether I should bluffly encourage the stiff upper lip or offer the consoling pat on the shoulder. In the latter department, Spots Binkle's specimens were not such as to invite contact, being more in the line of the Carpathian Mountains, sharp, hard, and like to bruise the tender flesh. But a decision was soon reached, and I extended a hand to pat the upthrust bony protrusion, adding the traditional, "Now, now, there, there," and "What's all this?" as indicated. The result was a fresh gusher, leading me to believe that I'd taken a wrong turn. I reviewed my stock of consoling phrases and realized that I had already emptied the store. I was considering a tactical shift toward the stiff UL when the door opened and slithy Tove Whipley entered the breakfast room with only slightly less swagger than your average pirate exhibits when boarding a prize.
"What ho, Barty?"
he said, sashaying over to the sideboard to survey the goods. I welcomed the change of focus, for it was he who, while purporting to show me the rocket ship he'd assembled on the lawn, had led me into its cramped saloon and asked for my views on a new cocktail he'd devised. An atom smasher, he had called it. I took a first sip and said, "I say, Slithy," as the brew's potency made itself felt. But no further words passed the numbed Gloucester lips. Instead, the lights went out, and I was plunged down a rabbit hole from which I did not emerge until I awoke in the depths of space. "Don't you what-ho me," I said, rising and casting aside a furious napkin. "The phrases unmitigated gall, dastardly trick, and absolute stinker were jostling one another in my brain to see which would be first out of the gate. I was also considering sharper than a serpent's bosom, though I wasn't quite sure it scanned well. But Slithy showed me the backs of his fingers, moving in a way suggestive of crumbs that were swept aside.
"Come on, Barty," he said, helping himself to scrambled eggs and a rasher of bacon I had thought looked a bit dodgy, it being an odd shade of green. "Can't you take a joke?"
"A joke? Well, that takes the biscuit." I had now marshalled gall, trick, and rotter into a single devastating phalanx and was about to send it crashing into Tove Whipley's line. But just then, Baldy gave forth with another freshet of woe, and it seemed somehow not the done thing to be offering battle when there were wounded in need of comforting.
Comfort, though, was not Slithy's style. "Buck up there, Baldy," he said, in a parade-ground tone, before sitting down and addressing himself to his plate in a manner that put one in mind of a wolf that had mastered the rudiments of wielding cutlery. I recalled that at school meals the other boys had always left a clear space around Tove Whipley. Hands other than his that penetrated the pail risked sudden and not inconsiderable injury. While I was thus briefly immersed in reminiscence, Baldy Spots Binkle rose from the table and, dashing tears from his eyes, fled the room. Slithy de-troughed himself long enough to grunt an ambiguous comment, or he might just have been loosening some morsel lodged in his throat, then returned to the clashing of silver on porcelain. Concern for Baldy drove my anger to the rear. I said, "I say, Slithy, what has cast Spots Binkle into the Slough of Despond?" He looked up at me, and around a mouthful of egg, said, "Newts." Well, of course, it would be newts. I should have seen that right away. Since his formative years, Archibald Spots Binkle had been entranced by the slimy little wrigglers. At school, in his study, he kept a covey of them in a glass tank, and would spend hours considering their ways, often dangling flies on strings before their muzzles. The rest of us boys, busy with our own interests, gave scant thought to Baldy's odd fascination. If we had, I suppose it would only have been to give thanks that he hadn't settled on some even less wholesome pursuit. And there lay our error. For as our boyhood interests gradually blossomed, if that's the word I want, into more manly fields, Baldy's traipsed off in the other direction. He grew ever more engrossed in his study of newts, to the point where it became his life's work. If he had ever mastered spelling, I'm sure he would have written a book about the little blisters. As it was, he launched learned papers at some journal that concerned itself with newtdom. Its editor, one Hudibras Gillatterly, F.R.S., routinely sent back these epistles with stinging comments, igniting a long, simmering feud that may well have enlivened whatever gatherings drew newt fanciers together. Through all this, Baldy stuck to his ancestral pile in the country, where he was mostly content, as the estate contained a pond that fairly seethed with newts. And there he would have remained, had he not, while on a newt-seeking ramble along bosky, bucolic lanes, happened upon one Marilyn Buffett, with whom he fell precipitously in love. Theirs was a stormy courtship, on one moment, off the next, into which I was unwillingly drafted as a patcher and restorer. At one time, a left-handed twist of fate had seen me engaged to Marilyn myself, a situation that chilled the Gloucester blood until it lay inert in the veins. In the end, thanks to a brilliant stroke by Greaves, who is rather deft in such matters, Baldy and Marilyn were delivered safely to the altar to become as one flesh. The thought of the large-eyed yet somewhat droopy former Miss Buffett now raised a question in the penetrating Gloucester mind. It was not like her to be hanging back in the shadows. She was a girl who liked to make her presence felt, not the sort to dominate a room, but certainly able to pervade it. So it struck me as curious that the room in which I stood and the bedroom in which I had awakened betrayed no trace of the Marilyn Spots Binkle oeuvre. Their respective wallpapers were not cloyed with flowers, the tablecloth was not embroidered with flocks of cheerful bluebirds, nor did every available surface bear a cluster of porcelain rabbits and mice, colourfully attired in the habits of rustic folk of a bygone age. For all the depth of my cogitations, no more than a moment had passed since Tove Whipley had voiced his one-worded explanation as to what was wrong with Baldy. I now advanced a new and possibly more pertinent question. "Where's Marilyn?" He raised his eyebrows in a meaningful way. "Earth." A shiver passed through. This news was not good.
In his salad days, before Marilyn had hove into view and taken him in tow, Baldy could have posed for a likeness of monomania. The realization that he was here on his own, and with Newts in the picture, boded ill. I sat down again at the breakfast table and lit a meditative cigarette, blew out a peal of smoke, and said, "Out with it, Slithy, the full chronicle." I won't reproduce his exact words, nor the several questions I had to put to elicit them. Conversation was never Slithy Tove Whipley's métier. He got by mostly on grunts and monosyllables. But the story that we together unfolded revealed that Baldy, after a lifetime of newt studies, had come to the melancholy conclusion that the field would henceforth offer him no new worlds to conquer. He had exhausted all that newts could offer him, and the realization caused him to fall into the aforementioned S of D. But then he had read in the papers of the emergent craze for rocketing off to Mars and Venus. The former did not interest him, being a dry place, but the descriptions he read of the planet named for the goddess of love, its vast swamps, its rain-sodden jungles, its mosses and lichens, could not help but to ring the one bell in Baldy's lightly furnished belfry. Here must be newts, and not just any newts, but new newts waiting to be discovered, newts that languished unobserved, loitering about in their watery lairs until a bulbous spot-spinkle eye should fall upon them and make them known. And then he had heard that his arch-foe Gelatterly had upped stakes from Warwickshire to build himself a house in the middle of a Venusian swamp. There he was, beavering away at winning the acclaim that warmed Archibald Spotsbinkle's dreams. He cast about for an early passage on a Venus-bound rocket, but was rebuffed at all the entrances. Jaunts to the Evening Star were this year's version of A Season in Monte Carlo. All ships were booked solid. There was not a chance of an empty berth before next year. But then a conversation overheard by chance in the Inertia Club opened the way before him. Slithy Tove Whipley, marked for eccentricity in a club that included the likes of Barking Mondley Spriggs and Flinders Bunchup, had caught the Venus infection. Not the newt variant, but the whiz-bang bug. He had already built a one-man rocket and flown it to Venus and back, and now he was seeking funds to build a more capacious model, which he would offer for charters. Gripped by manic energy, Baldy began sending telegrams. In short order, he became the major shareholder of the Tove Whipley Rocketry Company. He also sent several peremptory missives to Professor Gelatley, recommending that he cease all inquiries until a Spotsbinkle was on the scene. These telegrams were returned as undeliverable. Baldy redoubled his efforts to spur on Slithy Tove Whipley, writing a blizzard of checks. And soon the silvery dart was ready to rise on its tail of fire. Baldy, equipped with nets, rubber Wellingtons, and a yellow sou'wester, stepped aboard and blasted off in quest of newts. "And did he find them?" I asked the rocket man. "And how?" He chewed a piece of the local bacon. Apparently it was tough sledding, as it took him a while to clear the passages. "Pond. Middle of the estate. Newts abounding." He raised both hands, crumbs dropping from fork and knife. "Biggins." Another conundrum. A Spotsbinkle who had sought newts and found them in abundance ought to be dancing on moonbeams, not weeping over the kipper bones. There was little point in quizzing Slithy Tove Whipley. His last peroration had probably temporarily exhausted a year's supply of words. It would take hours for the cistern to replenish itself. I had a momentary inclination to seek out Greaves and lay the mystery before him. Greaves comes equipped with a prodigious brain, whose powers he augments by frequently dining on fish. But a Gloucester is also not without a neuron or two, and I resolved to pursue the matter myself. I went in search of Baldy. It was a fair-sized house. It appeared to have been brought over in prefabricated sections. but experience told me that if the grounds contained a pond that contained newts, on its shores would be the first place to look for a newt fancier. I first had to find boots and an oilskin. My +4s and tweed jacket, though eminently fashionable in Belgravia, would not have served. I sloshed my way from the rear of the house down what would have been a sloping lawn had it not been ankle-deep in moss. I found my old schoolmate on the banks of a dark pool, whose surface was continually stippled by the ceaseless downpour. The pond was not self-contained, but more of a widening in a sluggard of a river that separated the island on which stood the house from another bit of high ground, where Slithy Tove Whipley had parked the rocket. A stone bridge arched across a narrow stretch of the waterway to connect the two bits of terra firma. While I was taking in the lay of the land, I also noticed that a short distance from the house, someone had stuck a short, white, wooden stake in the ground. A little farther on was another, then two more leading down to the water. Near the bank, a few more bits of wood were scattered about, as if someone had been marking out a playing field for a game, but had grown tired of it and gone in to tea. Rambling down to where Baldy stood, and letting the bygones fall where they may, I offered a cheery, "What-ho?" He had been inspecting the water. I saw that he must have still been in a state of distress when he exited the premises, because he had neglected to clothe himself against the elements. His suit was drenched, as was he. His narrow shoulders hunched, and the rain ran down his collar. One would have to fare far and turn over many a rock to uncover a more morose specimen. He gave my greeting no answer, nor raised his eyes from the pond. "Once more unto the breach," I counselled myself, and said, "I say, this looks a dashed fine locus in quo for the odd lizard or two. What? He turned his mournful gaze my way. The downturn of his mouth put me in mind of a croquet hoop.
"Just the one," he croaked. "But what a one, Barty!"
And then came a fresh flood of tears. I again applied the consoling hand to the shoulder. "Come on, Baldy," I said. "Out with it. There's the stout fellow. What's it all about?" He snuffled and shook his head, droplets flying unnoticed in the downpour.
"Love, Barty," he said. "It's about love."